Greetings and welcome again to the New Books Network, the African American Studies channel. I'm your host, James Stansel, and today I'm going to be interviewing the author of Prison Power, How Prison Influenced the Movement for Black Liberation. Lisa M. Corrigan is the author. The book is published by University Press of Mississippi. I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. This is one of the first books to really talk about this topic, and she won some awards, which she's going to share with you. So listen up and enjoy. Hello, and welcome again to the New Books Network, the African American Studies channel. I'm your host, James Stansel, and I have the great pleasure of being here today with the author of Prison Power, How Prison Influenced the Movement for Black Liberation. Her name is Lisa M. Corrigan, and she is an Associate Professor of Communication, Director of the Gender Studies Program, and Affiliate Faculty in African and African American Studies and in Latin American Studies at the University of Arkansas. Hello, how are you doing today, Lisa? Welcome to the program.
I'm great, James. Thanks for having me today.
It is my pleasure. And, you know, when I saw your book and I saw the, you know, the book cover and it's published by our friends at the University Press of Mississippi, I said, man, this is such a great topic. And I wanted to have you on so you can share this subject with our audience. So absolutely. Thank you as well, Lisa Corrigan. So the first thing I want to do is maybe give you the opportunity to talk about your background, Lisa, and what really got you interested in this topic.
So I am a scholar who works in across a lot of disciplines. So I have done work in English literature and political science and in art history, and of course, communication, which is my disciplinary home, and African-American studies and gender studies. And so I was interested in really thinking about the way in which prison has influenced American political life, especially for Black Americans in the middle of the 20th century. And I suppose it came out of the fact that as a young kid, I mean, I came up in the 80s and my parents worked. And as a white kid growing up in poor rural Ohio, I started listening to hip hop really, really young. And I sort of joke that Eazy-E was my midwife because I listened to so much hip hop music as a little kid that it really restructured my ideas very young about power and about politics and about social violence and about gender and about race. And so when I got to graduate school, I was going to write about Blackness and political life in some way, but in the prison just seemed like it was the most important pressing space to excavate for me.
And, you know, the book Prison Power here, I mean, this is a wonderful cover that you have on the book here. Can you maybe tell us about, you know, how you came up with this cover and the title and kind of the significance of it?
Well, the book looks at the role of prison in shaping Black political life, both as a strategic intervention into Black politics as Black activists intentionally went into prison, and then also as a way of destroying Black activism as mass incarceration really developed steam during the middle of the 1960s. And so I thought Prison Power was a good way to describe the possibilities and the creative outlet that prison provided the Black freedom movement, but also it influenced Black liberation because it ultimately became a tool of destroying Black communities and the movement activists themselves. And I love the cover. The artists at University Press of Mississippi did a wonderful job. I actually sort of negotiated total artistic control over the cover in my contract, because that was very important to me that I would have control over the title and the cover. And so I sent them the picture. And for those at home, it's a composite picture of the Freedom Riders. And I like the prison pictures. It's all of their mugshots, because it shows us a wide variety of activists engaged in creative strategies around imprisonment, both Black and white, male and female, and some notable folks are here. You know, Stokely Carmichael's in this picture, Schwerner and Goodman and Cheney, who of course were lynched in 1964 during the
burning. Right.
They're in here. And so it's a composite picture of all of these civil rights activists who had gone into the prisons and found the struggle led directly through the belly of American incarceration.
Okay. Yeah, it's a beautiful cover, beautiful, and a somewhat sad way, obviously, because these are people who are being, you know, incarcerated in prison fighting for civil rights and human rights. But it's a very well done cover, as you mentioned. So kudos to you.
I like it because they ghosted, you know, you can see the some of the pictures are very clear, but then they ghosted some of the Black Liberation activists. And I like that because so many of the Black Liberation activists, especially who were mobilized in the South, you know, during 61, 62, 63, 64, 65, were disappeared.
Mm.
When they were looking for Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney in 64, during Mississippi Freedom Summer, they were dredging all of these bodies of water, and they were just finding all of these, you know, Black Americans that had gone missing, that had just been kidnapped and disappeared and tortured. And the kids who were down there doing voter registration in Mississippi said it was just so heartbreaking. Not only were their friends missing, but then they were finding just dozens and dozens and dozens of missing Black folk that had just been stolen and terrorized. And so it was really important to me that the cover get that story right and visually depict the people who put their bodies on the line, went into the prisons, were tortured there and assaulted there, and came out to do it again.
Right. Can you tell us a little bit about your process? Lisa, you talked a little bit about the cover there and the photos, but how long did it take for you to complete this book project, and what methods, research methods, did you use?
It took me 10 years to write it.
Mm-hmm.
So mostly because a lot of it was archival research. And so I was very fortunate to get to spend some time at the Freedom Archives out in San Francisco, and they have a lot of Pacifica Radio's archives and a lot of ephemera from the Black freedom struggle. And so Claude Marx was wonderful there, and I was able to go and work for a few days in their archives. And I did some work with the Lyndon Johnson Presidential Library and some of the oral histories that a lot of the members of the Justice Department had recorded there after the Johnson administration. And then I was able to work with quite a few of the publishers. So, for example, one of the chapters is on Mumia Abu-Jamal. And while I was at the Freedom Archives, I was just working on a computer. And Noel Hanrahan, who has produced most of his radio interviews from prison, I was using her computer, and she just happened to come in, and she gave me access to all of these radio interviews and you know, things that Mumia had been writing from prison for, you know, decades. And so there were some fortuitous moments like that, where I had access to activists themselves or people that were very, very close to them that helped get their work out of prison. The texts that I use, I'm looking mostly at their autobiographies for the case study chapters. And so I like autobiographies about Black freedom activists because they circulate so widely and they're so accessible to huge audiences, right? Different audiences. White people read them and eavesdrop. Black folks read them, right? I mean, they're productive and they're available to a wide variety of audiences. So I really like thinking about autobiography as a way that ideas travel and the way that people construct memory. One major difference is that the original draft of this years and years ago, the last chapter was about hip hop. And it was about the way in which Mumia Abu-Jamal, Rap Brown, now Jamil Elamine, and Assata Shakur circulate in hip hop culture as living martyrs, as the way that they carry messages of resistance and ideas about political prisoners into new generations to circulate. And I took that out for the book. So I've published pieces of that elsewhere in journal articles, especially about Assata and hip hop. But the new conclusion is all about the convergence of the war on Black America and the war on terror, in thinking about the way in which the discourse on the war on terror mobilized Assata Shakur, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and Rap Brown to help drum up support to both reinvigorate mass incarceration against Black Americans and to justify, you know, what now is ultimately like a Muslim ban, right? To reinvigorate this anti-Muslim sentiment. And so I'm really interested in how anti-Black and anti-Muslim sentiments converged during the Bush administration as a way of justifying a really extremist white supremacist Department of Justice.
And Lisa, you know, at this time, if you don't mind, can you maybe highlight or talk about some of the things that if people were to purchase or buy your book or look into it, that they could expect to see?
The book really argues that prison became the central space for the transformation from the Southern civil rights movement to Black Power as it became more Northern and more urban. And so I'm interested in how autobiographical writings, essays, and letters from prison, how they were produced, even starting with the sit-in movement, and how they really helped create a space within movement activism to understand the productivity of prison, what it meant to go into prison, what it meant for kids to go into prison, what it meant for middle-class Black folks to go into prison, what it meant to go into prison with white Northern college kids, and how that could help change the strategies and tactics of the movement as it agitated for social equality and voting rights. And then I'm interested in the other side, too, and about how the federal government and the states used the prison to help ultimately undermine Black freedom activism. And so I look at those writings to think about what I call the Black Power vernacular, which is the language of Black Power. Because in 1966, when Black Power is born as a slogan, as a political slogan, Stokely starts talking about it, Stokely Carmichael starts talking about it as a different kind of orientation of Blackness to whiteness. And it ultimately, by the end of 66, pushes almost all of the white liberals out of the major civil rights organizations and radicalizes them as a way of understanding Black activists' relationship to both Blackness and whiteness. And it's prison that does that. So the book talks a lot about how those autobiographical Black Power writings created different language that Black folks use to describe their relationship to the state, to each other, to white liberals, to the president, to their communities, and I think really made important contributions in elevating, Black street talk as a way of intervening into white politics. And so the Black Power activists, they, by 1966, had lost total confidence in Lyndon Johnson. They had never trusted the Department of Justice because of its collusion with the FBI, and they felt that they had to have a different way of understanding what kinds of work they could be doing in their own communities to wrestle power back from the white state, which persistently undermined, the equality that the nation said that it wanted to provide for all of its people. So I talk a lot about that kind of language, about Black Power language and the kinds of interventions that Black Power activists made in thinking about themselves as revolutionaries, as radicals, as guerrilla warfare, right? Thinking about guerrilla warfare as an invention that they think about. They think a lot about Third World Revolution and what they can learn from Third World Revolutions, especially the Cuban Revolution, but also the examples in Vietnam and Africa. They're thinking a lot about what it means to be an internal colony, what it means for Black people to live and exist inside of a colonial superpower as a minoritarian group. They are borrowing Third World liberation language to think about and interrogate their relationship to whiteness. Because the white liberals, they think that they're helping, right? They, in part, some of them have this missionary idea that they're helping Black folks, and some of them have this policy idea that if you just pass the right laws or you have the right court decision emerge or, right, the Supreme Court rules on a thing, that you will get equality. And Malcolm X's point is, I think, right on. 10 years after Brown versus Board of Education, only 9% of schools in the entire United States were desegregated. And so it's really hard, to take those kinds of legal decisions as the end-all be-all, as the thing that's going to somehow redistribute rights so that Black and brown people are equal. And so really the book talks at length about the kinds of language that the prison inspired for Black Power activists so that they could describe this extremely complicated process of domination that was happening in the United States.
And like I said, thank you so much for having an interest in this topic and really doing the research here, because I think it's really going to be interesting for people who pick up this book and listen to this podcast and really kind of get a feel, because I know for me, I felt like I was back during those times.
Well, they're telling their own stories, though. It's not just me. I'm just, sort of matching up the stories with the readers. so that people can read for themselves what was happening in the activist's own words, especially as a white scholar who does race work. You know, I think that it's an ethical imperative to think very, very long and hard about my role and the kinds of radical space that white people, I think, have an obligation to occupy to help amplify the voices of black activists. And so insofar as I can do that inside and outside of the university, I'm like there for it, man. I'm like the radical white woman who's like shouting about black power everywhere. And I feel like, and you know, but there have always been white women who have stood side by side, you know, especially in the black freedom struggle in the United States. Somebody else should write that book. I'm not going to write that book, but somebody needs to write that book and think about, you know, the role of white activists and white intellectuals and helping to amplify black voices. And so that's what I think that I'm doing, you know, with Prison Power.
All right. Lisa M. Corrigan, you don't want to write that book?
No, I've got a book that's due to the publisher this winter. It's tentatively titled Black Feelings. And it looks at the ways in which feelings both structure and are structured by politics. And so it starts with the Kennedy administration cultivating this notion of hope as a new political orientation after the hyperconsumption and political stagnation and conformism of the 1950s and the post-war years. And then it goes all the way through Huey Newton's book, Revolutionary Suicide, in thinking about how black activists exposed white feelings as bankrupt and as disingenuous and as problematic for black people, and invented new ways of orienting black consciousness towards different political feelings. And they then created different political strategies because they felt differently, you know. So Black Feelings is the next project, and it, I think, dovetails really nicely with Prison Power in thinking through how the black power vernacular really produced a different kind of cultural sentiment among black people, especially, you know, intellectual or radical black people, and especially after the assassination of Martin Luther King. I mean, the nation really changes. Black people feel very differently about white folks after 68, and black folks feel very different about nonviolence after 1968. And so as feelings change, so do politics. And I'm really interested in how that goes to go together, feelings and politics. So, but I'm not writing the book about white women in the civil rights movement.
not yet. Maybe we can talk about it further, and I can convince you later, Lisa M. Corrigan, to write that book, because I would love to have you back on to discuss that book as well. And we definitely want you on when Black Feelings comes out, right? So can I get a commitment from you right now?
Yeah, I have to do it. 100%, I'm in. I'm all in.
You're all in. Okay, so everyone, New Books Network, we have a commitment from Lisa M. Corrigan for her next book, Black Feelings. So we're going to get her to put that on ink. All right. Ink to paper. You haven't mentioned any of that Razorback stuff yet, right? You want to give a shout out to any of your University of Arkansas folk in that regard?
I mean, I have been very, very lucky at the University of Arkansas that the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences has supported this work. I'm really proud of Prison Power because it just won the National Communication Association's 2017 Diamond Anniversary Book Award, which is the major book prize in the field of communication. And I'm excited that the university has supported me writing this book because I think it's very timely. I think this political moment that we are living in calls for us to do deep and sustained, thoughtful investigations into the structures of domination and violence that permeate American political life, especially for our most precarious citizens, you know, be they Black Americans or be they Puerto Ricans or be they, you know, immigrants. And so I've just been tremendously lucky that the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas has been so supportive as I've written this book and has been so generous with their financial support. I've been able to get a little bit of leave time away from teaching to write it, and some internal grant money to facilitate some of the research. And it's the very first book about race that has ever won the Diamond Anniversary Book Award. And so I hope that it will not be the last.
Outstanding, Lisa M. Corrigan. And that says something about you as a writer and scholar, as well as your topic here.
Well, let's be honest about it. I'm a white woman, and I'm being rewarded for writing about radical blackness. And that's also problematic. You know, I'm proud of the book. I did solid work. I'm glad it won the prize. but also there's a responsibility to talk about, you know, how often Black folks write about their own stories and they don't get any recognition at all. So, you know, I'm proud of the award, and I need, you know, obviously I have to talk about it, but it's a melancholy thing for me because, you know, I am being socially promoted writing about something that Black folks have been saying for the entirety of their history in the United States. And so, you know, I just don't want that to not be part of the conversation too. You know, I'm happy to amplify the voices to connect the book with audiences for people who need to hear it and who maybe need to hear it from white people. But at the same time, you know, the fact that it's the first book about race to win the award speaks to a much larger erasure of Black voices in the culture. And that seriously has to be rectified, you know, not just in academic publishing, but in every aspect and facet of American life.
Well said. Lisa M. Corrigan, you just made it a part of the conversation right here on the New Books Network.
Yes, I did. It has to be said, man. It's got to be said.
Yeah.
Black folks do not get rewarded for talking about Black power. They do not. That in American life, they have been killed. They've been assassinated. They've been disappeared, you know, or they've been forced into exile. So for me to get rewarded writing about it, you know, it's a mixed sort of thing. And we have to acknowledge both sides of that, the complicity that white people have in structures of white supremacy and, you know, the important work that has to be done by white people to talk to white people about, you know, Black and brown lives. And so for me, I do talks all around the world about Black power to a lot of white people. And my students in class, I was talking about Malcolm X the other day, and they're like, do you think that this would be different if you were a Black person? And I'm like, yeah, you would think that I had an agenda. You would write me off. You would immediately click into a bunch of cognitive bias and anti-Black sentiment that you don't even know is in your brain. And you would dismiss the things that I was saying because I was Black. But the fact that I'm white and talking about these figures who are extremely important in structuring American political life, and I'm white, you hear those things differently. It has a different kind of credibility. So, especially because University of Arkansas is a predominantly white institution. You know, I'm with white people all the time talking about radical Black stuff. And so I feel like, you know, more white people need to take up more space among their own people and civilize white folks so they stop killing Black folks in the streets. I feel very strongly about it, James.
Lisa M. Corrigan, you just put it out there.
It's got to be done. I mean, that's the only way stuff is going to change. Black people know that they're humans. White folks can't seem to get it through their heads. So if it takes me writing all the books from now until I die, that's what I'll be doing.
All right. And the more you write them, the more we're going to have you on New Books Network, the African American Studies channel.
I'm happy to do it, man. You know, I just appreciate what you're doing over here and connecting these books to people who are interested in reading and thinking about Black life. And, you know, this is a really precarious moment in human history generally, but in American history particularly. And the prison especially is just a towering space for just the prosecution of Black life. And, you know, when I was writing the book, these series of stories came out, I think, in The Atlantic about Chicago and about all of these Black ops secret prisons all across Illinois that Black folks have just been getting disappeared into for years. Like, you get picked up by the police and nobody knows where you went or where the intake was, or no forms. I mean, literally, they are just like Abu Ghraibs, these like Black ops sites in Illinois that Black folks get disappeared into as these secret prisons. And that stuff happens all around the globe all the time. And it's mostly Black and brown folks. And in America, even though the rates of incarceration are creeping up for Black women, it's still mostly Black men disproportionately that are being incarcerated. And that just has to stop. I mean, it just has to stop. So I'm happy to see films and miniseries take up the issue of mass incarceration. And I'm happy to see that people are finally starting to think about the role that prison plays in the destruction of Black communities. But it's not just prison. You know, one of the things that the activists in the book talk a lot about is that their understanding of the prison really helped them understand why slavery has never really left. You know, we still have we still have penitentiaries across the American South that still operate as plantations. They make money for the state. And that in addition to corporate prisons, which have no transparency and no accountability, you know, function as ways of disappearing Black folks and destroying Black community and prohibit Black communities from building generational wealth and destroy families and create the school-to-prison pipeline. In Arkansas, for example, we build prisons based on the literacy rates of third-grade Black boys. Now, you tell me, I mean, that is racist. That's just, there's no way to describe that. That's just fundamentally racist. How can we remove these Black men from the productive economy and force them to be, right, disappeared as slaves inside of the American prison system? And it's only going to get worse before it gets better unless people start thinking really about how, critically about how, you know, prison works to disrupt Black communities. So I'm... Even though it took me 10 years to write this book, and I'm so proud of it, this is in some ways an important moment for it to appear and circulate, you know?
And on that note, Lisa, I don't want to hold you all day. Thank you for taking some time for us on the network here while you're at the University of Arkansas. But I wanted to give you an opportunity before we close out to talk about some of the other additional things, the places where people could find you and your work. I know you mentioned your upcoming book, Black Feelings, right?
Yep.
So some other places we could find your work or you and you. I know we talked offline about your podcast as well, if you don't mind sharing.
Sure. So with my co-host, Laura Wiederhoft, I have a podcast called Lean Back, Critical Feminist Conversations. And so we're very interested in talking about the relationship among race, gender, sex, class, and power, and the way that women and men and trans folks and non-gender binary conforming individuals think about work and labor and family and attraction. And so the podcast has 3 episodes out now. We're in about 60 countries across the world. And Pace Magazine just named us the number one podcast in Arkansas. So that's Lean Back. You can find us on Twitter at Lean Back Podcast. You can live stream on SoundCloud or iTunes or Google Play. Any of your podcast platforms will have Lean Back. And then, you know, I also do politics. So I work as an unpaid consultant and trainer for caucuses, legislators, county party organs, and activists. And I do political trainings about building grassroots political power and about how state legislatures and the federal government work. So I am very pleased to have contributed to something called the Indivisible Guide. And so if you're online at all, you probably have seen Indivisible Activists. There are about 4,000 chapters across the country now that have grown since the election, since the presidential election. And they have been the ones disrupting town halls and holding public forums over things like the Affordable Care Act. And so I also travel a lot and do a tremendous amount of political consulting for all kinds of organizations around progressive issues and around, you know, political history, especially in the American South. And you can find me on Twitter at Dr. Lisa Corrigan, where I'm generally talking about Black politics and grassroots activism and gender work. So those would be great places to find me on the Internet.
That sounds pretty good. And so hopefully folk will get in contact with you there if they have questions about some of the things that you mentioned on the podcast today, or they want to talk with you about prison power or Black Feelings or some of the future projects that you have. As you all can hear there, Lisa M. Corrigan is pretty busy.
That is the truth of it. All need to be busy, though. This is our future, you know.
So not just with her academics at University of Arkansas, but outside of the classroom there as well. So we're definitely grateful that she took some time to talk with us on the New Books Network. So thank you so much, Lisa M. Corrigan, for talking with us today about your book. So you can click through on our blog page on New Books Network and you can purchase the book. And of course, you can listen to this podcast and listen to Lisa's podcast as well that she mentioned. So on that note, we're going to close it out here. Again, thank you so much, Lisa M. Corrigan, for spending some time with us on the African American Studies channel of the New Books Network. And if you could just say goodbye to our audience for us.
Thanks so much, James. Thanks for having me here. I'm happy to come back anytime, man.
Absolutely. Hey, we're going to get you for Black Feelings. Don't worry. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk a little more offline about that white women and civil rights.
That's a real deal.
We need to get you working on that one too. So
thanks so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for spending some time and sharing your deep thoughts with our audience. And we're going to close there. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. This is your host, James Stansel, the New Books Network, the African American Studies Channel. Peace and love. Thank you so much, Lisa M. Corrigan, the author of Prison Power, How Prison Influenced the Movement for Black Liberation, published by the University Press of Mississippi, for taking some time with us today. And as you heard, she's pretty busy doing things outside of her university teaching. So thank you so much for spending some time with us on the network. Definitely check out her podcast and some of the other things that she mentioned. I think you're going to enjoy it if you enjoyed hearing her on our network today. So thank you so much for listening, everyone. See you soon.